Okay, you're on now, so go ahead.
So, anyway, we have, these are my little pet peeves. And this, I was at the Senior Citizen Center. I was on the board of directors of the seniors, and I used to go up there a lot because I was on the board of directors, and I was interested. And then, of course, after Kelly became not ill, but we knew that he was manifesting something, and it was a cancer, I started spending much more time with him, you know. Although I did before, I spent much more time, and we're almost inseparable now, you know, because I think that he needs me, you know, and it's important. But I spent a lot of time up there, and I used to have lunch, and here there's an extension service lady, some really gung-ho young thing, you know. And she was talking down to, you know, the seniors. And we had seniors that were in their 90s, you know, very, very able to speak up and say what they thought and things like that. And she was saying, "And you people plant a garden," she said. "Get yourself some seeds and plant a garden." And old Pelageya Malutin, who was 93, listened to her for a while, and she was saying, "Plant a garden," she said. "Get out and get some exercise. Plant a garden, plant some vegetables," she said. "They're so good for you." And Pelageya listened to her for a while, and finally she said, "We done that." She said, "We did all that stuff." She said, "I don't want to do it no more." And it just tickled the daylights out of it. I thought, oh boy. Nothing daunted. It didn't disturb this woman at all. I mean, I find it, you know, most seniors are doing what they want to do. Absolutely. They're doing what, if they don't do anything, they're doing what they want to do.
And that's okay.
Well, of course it's okay.
Yeah.
I find myself just doing nothing sometimes. Of course, I busy myself. I write in my journal, and I play maybe some solitary, or I do a lot of handwork, you know. But if I don't want to do anything, I don't do anything, you know. I can't do a whole lot of cleaning, but I spend an awful lot of time cleaning house. Yeah. In fact, I had a cleaning girl for years, you know, because of the, it's hard for me to push a vacuum cleaner. You know, it requires air to energy, you know, and I struggle too much to do it. Of course, I've always been heavy, which is something to be, you know, that if I were thinner, it would be easier for me. But this is the way I am. And so I do just exactly what I want to do. I belong to organizations because I like to do it, you know. And then, of course, too, I'm kind of, soothes my ego to do these things. You know, I'm president of our Pioneer Women's Auxiliary and things like that. But I enjoy doing these things.
One thing that people miss the mark on in life, I mean, is that life is to be enjoyed. That doesn't mean it's like TV of the hedonistic sort of thing of the party or whatever, you know, the material enjoyment. But like, do the things you want.
Of course,
it's,
of course.
It's part of what life is about. And you can do that usually in the context of your life. Because usually what you do, what you want to do is being in touch with your family.
Of course. And this is the thing, that's the only thing that I really strive at doing, you know. Lately, there's been one member of our family he's not really our family, he's one of the in-laws, but he's caused a great deal of problem. We have always been so close, and our family has, and this person, on the year that Kelly and I were married 50 years, caused such a great big rift that Kelly and I just couldn't have a celebration. We were going to have a big celebration, you know. And I'd been anticipating it and looking forward to it, but it caused such a rift between two of the girls that we just couldn't. It was even unthought of, you know. And of course, this person twisted around, so it was the girl's fault, you know, this one that was having all the trouble thrown at her. And he has continued to to behave in this manner, which has made it, you know, it's divided our family. And it's a really sad thing. It's sickening, too, you know. Just, but you don't... Oh, Kelly went to the store. You went to the store first, huh?
Okay, go ahead.
When they voted statehood out, oh, here's some of Natalie Senior. When they voted statehood out, then one of the things that came back in was gillnetting, because they couldn't gillnet without because of these traps, you know, the fish traps that the big companies had all over the place. So here's a bunch of pictures. So Kelly picked out a place that he wanted to gillnet. You know, he decided that from now on, this is, oh, we must have been, this is in 60, 1959, you know, 60. He picked out a place for us to gillnet. And so we arranged our lives. You know, Freddie was, our youngest son was 13, 14, I think. So we arranged for him to go to boarding school. And Kelly and I proceeded to move out of town. You know, he got a partial time job as a winter watchman at one of the canneries. And we would go fishing in the summertime, our fish site, which Freddie came to fish with his dad, you know. And then he would leave for school in the fall, and we would move to the cannery for the winter and watch this one cannery, you know, that belonged to the San Juan Fishing Company. And it was wonderful, but like I say, I had no stimulation. I had to find all sorts of things to do to keep myself occupied and happy, because I was used to having all sorts of things to keep me busy and to keep me interested. So. That was when I started listening to the talk shows on the radio. You know, I would turn them on, even as fuzzy as the static was terrible, but I would turn them on and I would listen for 2 or 3 hours every night to the, and so I became quite versed in all the things that were happening in the world. You know, that's one way of knowing what's happening, is to listen to the radio, you know, to listen to, especially to the talk shows. And this real crusty character called Ira Blue was on. He was really an interesting person. And I would listen to him all the time. But I think besides this asthma, you know, that manifested, it began to manifest itself, was the reason why we moved out of the Bay. We found that we couldn't really cope if anything happened to us. One time, one of our friends left our place, and on the way out, we could just, as he was going out of sight around one of the bends, something happened with his motor, and it hit him or knocked him over or something. Nobody knows, because Kelly was, you know, this was quite a distance, and his boat stopped, and the motor made a big buzz, and that stopped. And here we were. We had just got in the day before, and we couldn't go any place because we didn't have our boat launched. All the boats were pulled up. Our CB didn't work. And we were quite a distance away from everybody else, and the beaches were almost impassable sometimes, you know. So we had to walk. And in November, with snow on the ground and miserable wet, you know, and me with asthma, we made it, but it was really a chore. And then we began to realize that we couldn't live out there anymore. You know, this was in the 1970s. We were already moving, staying in here part of the time, you know, several months a year, and then we would live out there. But we would go out there in early May and stay all summer long and come back home in October, you know, and spend the winter months here. But finally, we just began to... stay in here all the time and just go out there for just little visits. But we haven't been back for about 6 years now.
So you lived in Woody Island till when?
Till our till Freddie was about 6 years old, to our youngest son, till about 1952, maybe.
So all of your children, basically, he grew up on Woody Island.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. It was a wonderful life for them. They loved it. They, in fact, this does seem strange, doesn't it? I mean, all the things that children like to do, the dances and all the activity and things like that, happen over here in Woody Island. Well, we had our own social group over there, too. We belonged to, my husband worked for the FAA, and we had our club, and we had our fun times, and we had our PTA, and we just, and there was...
But how many people were there?
Well, there must have been PTA people. There must have been women, men, women, and children. There must have been 100 and some odd.
Oh, that's a lot.
You know,
yeah.
And there was two sections, East Woody and West Woody, you know, mm-hmm. that they lived at. And we had a recreation room and a big school. And our children went to school there, and the high school students commuted, you know, on the boat every day to town.
Now, what boat was that?
The Fedair. It was their ferry
uh-huh.
that was a boat out of Juneau. I think Juneau that they brought up here too. It was, I imagine, 40 foot, something like that.
Does this still happen? Are there still people there?
No. They've gone out of commission. I don't know just how long it's been, but. Now, whatever activity goes on over there is happens over here, and somebody goes over and checks the place. But they've had two or three fires, and you know, there's a lot of transients that go around, and they take things down and steal the lumber and steal the furnishings and things like that. And so I guess it's. And people were camping. In fact, my mother's old house burnt just 3 or 4 years ago. Somebody was camping in there. But vandals, you know, you like to think that a church group would look after their children and things like that. You know, they have a Bible group over there, but they would go into houses and they just wreck everything, you know, and they just trashed things, you know.
Again and again.
Oh, I know, it's terrible.
It?
And these children, these nice little children do these things. They did the same thing to my sister's home. They just went in there, you know, while she was over here, and she had moved out, but she hadn't moved her things. They just trashed things. I think that if that happened to me, I would just really do something.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody stole Mama's rocking chair, her old clock, her sewing machine.
Oh.
And... It's just unbelievable that people do things like that, you know. I can't even think of myself ever doing anything.
Oh no, I mean, I wonder what is in someone's mind to even think of doing
really,
that.
Really. Anyway, this is what you know. I grew up on the island. Kelly and I married in 1935, something like that. And
how old were you when you married, Kelly?
I was 21, 22, I think. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we lived over on the island and built our home there, just close to where my mother lived. And then in 1940, after the war was over, we moved over to town here so that Kelly could work, because there is no work there. He relied purely on fishing. He would fish in the summer and then would just stay home during the winter. And that just, you know, it wasn't enough for a family of four, which we had four children at the time. So we moved over here and he worked for the various places in town. He worked for one of the construction men and then on the city group. And then we found, in 1948, I think, we found that we could move back to the island. We could buy our old house back. And we could move back. Yeah, we had sold it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we found we could buy it back and move back to the island, and that if we moved over there, that they would have enough children to start a school. So we moved back, and oh, it was a heavenly time. So happy to go back home, you know, all of us. Really. And we stayed over there until 19, I forget just when it was. It was sometime in 1956. I think 56, the children say 52, but I don't believe it was 52. I think it was later. Anyway, Kelly, it was during the time of the Eisenhower administration when they froze all government leaves, mm-hmm. and Kelly was in the FAA, you know. And so he always went fishing on his leave time. And he absolutely insisted on going fishing. We fought for 3 days, or I cried. Mm-hmm. I cried because I liked the steady salary and this, you know, a fisherman goes through periods of times of nothing and times of plenty. It's not, you don't hit a happy medium oftentimes. You're just up and down, you know, mm-hmm. and it's chicken one day and feathers the next, you know. Anyway, I talked and talked and talked, and he said, oh, you're losing faith in me, you know. Mm-hmm. I've always been able to make a living. And so finally, he just quit, you know. He quit and went fishing. And so then started the struggle, you know. I didn't want to leave the island. The children didn't want to. They were adamant, can't leave. But Kelly had to work, and the only work was crab fishing, you know. There was a tremendous lot of crab fishing then going on, and it was, you know, quite lucrative. And so this is what happened. He moved, and we stayed over there. Well, we stayed over there for several months, but it could, you know, we couldn't do much without a man. You know, pipes freeze up in the wintertime and this sort of thing. And so finally, we just gave up. I just gave in, and we moved. We had a home here that we had bought, you know, mm-hmm. that we had been renting. We moved into it, back into it, and we've been over here ever since, except for the time that we moved out of town. Ellen, our oldest daughter, has been kind of a second mother to the children. You know, she took over Freddie, our youngest son, who was then 13 or 14, something like that. He went out to boarding school, and he would, I think the first summer he stayed in town because he wanted to play Little League. But the rest of the time he was at boarding school, or he was out with us on the beach. And we stayed out there from 1960 until in the 70s. Must have been about 74 when we completely moved, 75. Mm-hmm. 74, because by then Peter had passed on. Freddie was dead. He was killed in Vietnam. And I don't know why. I never thought. I suppose we all think that at some time or another that you're invincible, that nothing will. And when I look back on it, I look and I think, you know, we never thought of the imminence of losing one in the family. We just, even when Freddie enlisted, he went to officers training school and he was a helicopter pilot. I never thought that he would be killed. I just never thought of it. And then he was only over there a few short months, no, a few short weeks, 5 weeks. And he was killed. And then, like I was telling you, you know, Peter was just devastated. He was, of the two, you would think that Freddie was the older one because he would talk to his brother and they would do things together. And he kind of comforted him, I guess, you know. Peter was oftentimes troubled. You know. Anyway, Peter died 2 years afterward, and I couldn't stay out at the bay. There was too many memories, you know, because we all loved being out there, and we would have all the grandchildren. They would come. We'd have as many as 5 or 6 or 7 or 8. We'd put up a tent, and we had a cabin, and we just had them out there, you know, and I didn't know that it was making such an impression on these children, you know. They would come out early in the summer, and they would spend the whole summer, and then they'd come home later on, you know. And now when we look back and we talk about it, the girls, I've heard the girls say, my most favorite place to be on earth, Euganic, you know. at Cottonwood, our home there. And it pleases me, you know, to think that we created this, you know, for them, that even now they would like to live back there again. You know. In fact, some of them plan on building there. And of course, Kelly and I, at the time, you know, of course, the Alaska Native Land Claims was going on then. And we, through our Native corporation, they set aside a mile square of land for the Natives to build on and things like that, which had already been set aside by Stuart Udall in 1948 for village purposes, but they just made a motion of giving it to us, you know, saying you can have this, this is yours, kind of a sop. It didn't matter. It didn't really matter because Kelly and I had already started several years before to petition the Alaska State for the land surrounding our home out there and things, mm-hmm. and we eventually got it. You know, we got 60-some acres, I think, of our land out there. And we're very happy, you know, having that. It's, are you cold, dear? And the rest of the time we just spent it here. I worked until, I worked for 5 years. I think 4 or 5, I was just going on the 5th year when I quit. So I must have went to work before 74. And I worked I started in as a health careers, coordinator, I guess it was. And this was going out and soliciting children and talking to kids in school. You know, I would go and I would give a talk at the high school, and I would go to the various villages and talk on following a health career, you know, to get people to interested, because there was quite a bit of money going into these programs, you know, and of course there was plenty of money going into CANA, you know, the Kodiak Area Native, which is a nonprofit organization. And so I started at $7.50 a month, and I didn't mind. I thought that was fine. I just wanted to work, you know, just get my mind moving on something. And throughout, I finally ended up for a few short months as the health director. But I had worked under some expert people, you know. I worked awfully hard, and I, you know, you've heard of the Peter Principle. I finally worked up to the level of my own incompetence. I knew that.
And most people don't realize it. That's the difference.
I knew that, and it was devastating to think that I would either have to go on to school and learn more, or I would quit. But I was ready to quit anyway, you know, because Kelly and I are, you know, we do things together, we live together, we like to do things together, and he was retired, you know, so I just never went back, you know. And then too, because that was quite a plum, those jobs, you know, not this particular job, but because the directorship was quite a particular plum, there was a lot of people vying to get those jobs, and you know, by hook or crook, a lot of them didn't care what they did to get them, you know. And I didn't like that. I don't like anything that's devious or manipulated, because this was supposed to be for our Native people. It was something that was supposed to help them, and I hope that I didn't ever digress, is that the word? I mean, from this particular thing that I was there to do, you know. And I don't know if I made any impression. I doubt it. But our people are funny sometimes. They're funny. They're so used to it. It's not funny. They're so used to the fact that they've had to step back, you know, and to make way for a non-native, that now they look up to them for direction. They do it all the time.
Without realizing.
It's mm-hmm. so, mm-hmm. it makes you feel terrible. I know, you know, because here we were working hard and then they'd walk right past you to go on to one of the lesser people in rank because they were a white person and they felt that they knew better what was going on because they looked to them because they were white.
And how could you know better but your own people about
well,
your own people?
Well, of course. And this was the sad, mm-hmm. deplorable thing. And
do you think it still happens to the same
person? Oh, I'm sure of it. And you know, the uh-huh. thing that really, I didn't mean to get on this subject because it's a sore spot with me, is that here are our people working at the menial jobs. Mm-hmm. You know, they're the receptionists, what do you call it? The stenographers that they have to go through rigorous training for six months or 6 weeks, whatever it is that they go through training, and doing all the menial tasks, but none of the principal part of the job is ever given to them. To the native people.
I didn't realize that was still the way. Oh, the
yes, it is. Yes. Well, look down here. Look down here. It's sad. It's it really gets to me. Once they get entrenched, though, and then they, you know, and then of course they bring in their friends. And there's a group there that. Are working in the humanities area, you know, not the humanities, but the social mm-hmm. end, and they're mostly all these religious, groups, and they're bringing in all of their people, you know, they're and I can't feel that they're that good because. They're working under the drug, what do you call it? And they haven't had any experience. But because they want to so badly, I suppose they feel like they're the best people. I almost fell over dead when Val Benton was going to give a talk on drug awareness. And what the hell does she know about drug awareness? She's a Christian woman, I'm sure, and she's a nice woman, but she acts like a dingling as far as I'm concerned. But here she is. Telling our people, you know, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They probably know more about it than she does.
Ever understand?
Well, that's mm-hmm. that's the thing. That these are the things that, mm-hmm. but our people allow it.
Yes, that's the sad.
See,
part.
That's the sad like part. Instead of getting in there and fighting, they'll step back always.
Mm-hmm. But you know, when you tell me about your early life in the mission and things, I can see where you see everything comes from childhood. I'm sure that you're just. It's so hard to overcome that.
Yes, I know. I know it is. It still is. And, you know, I'm finally beginning to learn to speak up. And
yes, but and do we all have to wait till we're in our 70s?
I know.
We have the courage.
I know.
And it's not courage. It's a matter of awareness or...
Of course, I now see, I don't know about Richard, and I'm sure he does because he does speak up. And Kelly is just, you know, that's young Kelly. Attila spends most of her time talking, you know, lecturing, mm-hmm. giving talks, things like that. And Ellen absolutely says whatever she thinks. If she thinks something is wrong, she says so. Christina the same way. So I guess maybe we've given them that, you know, mm-hmm. that they mm-hmm. will not stand for this type of thing. I oftentimes, you know, a lack of education is a bad thing, especially if you want things. It's nice to say, well, you know, you're very articulate, these kinds of things, but there's still a lack. And it's sad because you feel like if you just had that little bit more that maybe you could go on to other things, not so much for your own satisfaction. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, that's mm-hmm. the thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's so, I love to learn. You don't get tired learning, you know. Everything is exciting and new. You go on to newer things and mm-hmm. learn more. I think maybe I'd like to be a lawyer.
Oh, I think you'd make an excellent lawyer. I mean, a good lawyer.
Yeah,
in fact, one with some awareness and compassion for...
For a long time, I just continued to collect credits, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then I just dropped out completely. I continued to collect credits so that I could at some time maybe have a degree.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of lost the urge. I haven't been doing it because, oh, you get more laid back finally. You're not so aggressive and you don't...
But you seem to have passed that spirit on to your children. I mean, maybe they're doing...
Oh, yeah. Well, that's right. One of them is going on to computer training. She takes care of the books and things. Of course, she's had a lot of experience doing this type of thing, but
getting back to the Native thing, what positive changes do you see in the over the years? I mean, since you were growing up and all through the Native land claims till now.
I don't think that one of the positive things, and that's happened just recently, is the fact that they're moving towards closing down alcohol, you know,
mm-hmm.
the consumption of alcohol in the villages. That to me is one of the biggest things, you know.
And they did that without any white help or any, I mean.
Rural cap and those had their alcohol seminars and things like that. But I think that they were ready for this. I think that they were ready for this. And they had to do it themselves because to begin to have your city dry, you must have a town meeting and decide that this is what you want. And you don't have anybody telling you what to do at a town meeting. You do your own thing, you know. At
mm-hmm.
these villages,
mm-hmm.
and this is what has happened. I never thought I'd live to see the day that this would happen on Kodiak, but it has, and this one village, these people just decided that this was it. I imagine there's about 100 people there. They decided that they didn't want their children to grow up like this, and they just started working with the alcoholism groups and started to have affairs and things for their children and devote more time to doing things that didn't have any alcohol or alcohol related or anything. Of course, I've heard that since they've fallen by the wayside, but I think they've picked themselves up and gone back, you know.
No.
And that, to my estimation, is one of the things. I can't really see too much progress, except in maybe they have the sports group, you know. But as far as I can't see a whole lot.
So do you feel that there's still as much discrimination? I mean, it's maybe it's more subtle, but it's still there.
Well, it's there, and I think it will be. You know, I think it will be. It's. I don't know. I can't say. Of course, I think that Kodiak is better than most places.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Kodiak is a whole lot better because they've sort of infiltrated, you know, within the groups. There's a lot of marriage, intermarriage, and things. This type of thing, you know, so that it's kind of a mixture of people and. But there's still, you know, some racial prejudice.
What do you think of the Native land claims thing? What do you think is going to happen in 1992?
I don't know. I don't know. I just, I don't really, I think that one thing that the land claims did was bring the Native people together. It made a union of them, which was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's exciting and thrilling. But like everything else, the unscrupulous people have gotten, there's some that are very, very good, you know,
mm-hmm.
some corporations, but
unscrupulous people get a hold of something, and they are absolutely the toughest thing to get out that you
oh,
ever.
And that's all across the board. It has nothing to do with natives or male or female or poor
that's right.
or anything.
And
yes.
it's and they're just they're using the money like our corporation. I sad to say this, but this one person is on their end, and they make themselves big salaries and this type of thing. You know, they just mm-hmm. perpetuate their jobs, and they could care less about mm-hmm. the natives.
Mm-hmm.
Really,
yeah,
they drive around in nice cars, and
mm-hmm.
now I resent them making laws and things like that for me, who live right here where this corporation is supposed to be.
Excuse me, there's this.
I haven't even heard.
This is Jean Lester continuing on with Natalie Simeonoff in Kodiak on the.
That's what I was telling you about this woman called. She got into an argument with my stepfather about the milk, you know, the milk soured one morning that we had delivered to her. We sold milk, you know, as a sort of a byline. And the milk soured, and she was blaming it on my father. Well, my father said, you don't have to buy milk from us, you know.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, very independent. But he felt that, you know, she was a lazy woman. She didn't get up in the morning,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so the milk soured because the weather was hot, and she you know, hadn't gone out and taken it, picked it up. And so later on she was making this remark, you know, she was talking to another woman and she was angry. She said, they're poorer than Job's turkey. And she said, and he presumed to talk to me like that, you know. And I didn't know he was talking about us. I didn't know she was talking about us. And the ladies that were listening to her were highly incensed. And they said, why didn't you say something? I said, what for? They said, well, she was talking about you, your family, and I didn't know it.
You never felt poor.
No,
I think poor is often, not always.
A state of mind. Yes,
mm-hmm.
yes,
mm-hmm.
I agree with you. And, you know.
You need to unhook.
Well, here, I can reach this. I need to, so this is what we used to do, what Mama used to do. She, as I said, was a kind of a pet with people up at the mission. But she also did many things. She could sew, you know, very well. She was an extremely good seamstress. She could knit, she could crochet, she could cook, she could do everything. And so she would, the mission shipped up, you know, the mission society shipped up boxes and boxes of good things, you know, materials and clothing, used clothing. And Mama would take the, they would bring the old coats and things down to us, and we would turn the material, and Mama would make jackets for the mission children out of them.
Why not for you?
We did that too, because they gave us a lot of the clothing, you know. And so this is what I don't believe I ever had a button coat up until I was grown up, you know. But we were perfectly happy because we all could sew too.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to tell you this, you know, talking about sheep, when we used to, we learned to spin yarn, you know.
Yes, I was fascinated with that. I wondered where you got it, and then I read it.
We learned to spin yarn, and we used to pick it. We used to pick it off of the bushes. You know, this fellow out at the ranch had sheep, and as the sheep wandered around, the fleece would get stuck on the bushes.
Yeah.
And while we were down there, we would pick bags of this. And then we would take it home, and Mama would wash it, and she'd card it. We'd just card it with an old comb or something, you know. And then we'd spin it. I have a spindle and carding brushes, you know, that I can do. In fact, I made Kelly a pair of Artics just for the fun of it, because we use that principally to finish off the men's socks and things like that, you know. When the men's socks wore out, we just rip out the bottom and knit in a new pair of feet, and then, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's one job that I deplored. I just hated darning socks. We did a lot of it, you know. The mending basket was always full, you know. But in the evenings, my mother had, I don't know, I suppose she needed to do things like that. So, we just went along with her. We would either cut rags for rugs, or we'd knit, or we'd crochet, or we'd spin, you know, yarn. And we were the first ones in our neighborhood to have a radio, you know. Dad was kind of up and coming. He liked to have the more modern things. And so we were the first ones with an oil stove, which was the bane of my mother's life. She would just go out of her mind that every once in a while the puff of air would come in and the stove would give a mild explosion and mom would grab us all. Rushing out of the house, and I would be brave, you know, I'd stay behind, and she'd get so angry at me. Mother didn't swear, but she was, these days she did. She'd grab all the children, and now she's very protective of us. But we would listen to the Purina Hour. Mm-hmm. We'd listen to, and nobody touched the radio except Dad or Mama. Never anybody. But which was fine, you know. We just never touched it. But he would turn in on the Purina Hour around 6 or 7 o'clock, and we'd listen to Minnie Pearl and all these. Amos and Andy was another favorite of ours, and we'd listen to The Hound of the Baskervilles, you know, by Sir Conan Doyle, and all of those really super programs And this was one of our sources of amusement, you know, besides going to church and picnics. Of course, I think the nice thing about my life is the fact that I enjoyed doing the things that to many other people would be a chore, you know.
Well, that's a secret of life, isn't it?
Really. I enjoyed going out and getting wood, you know, mm-hmm. Taking the skiff, pushing it down. It entailed a lot of work, believe me. Mm-hmm. But it didn't seem like work because it was nice to get out in the sunshine and row the skiff along the shore and stop where there was a nice big bunch of wood and load it into it, because it was always wood that we women could handle, you know. And we'd take the children. You want to go to the door?
Sure, I'll go see
the things. I loved working in the garden, for instance, and that was a tremendous necessity, you know. We had to grow enough potatoes to last us most of the winter, and by this time we were discovering, you know, by the time that we had a garden, we were discovering that we had to do things to supplement our income, because we had quite a large family, you know. Yeah. And we had 7 children. And thank God I stopped having babies, because Kelly would have his nose to the grindstone for the rest of his life anyway, you know.
And in those days, it's so interesting to look back, because nowadays when it's so easy to stop having babies, but in those times it wasn't that easy.
Mm. No, that's right. And I had my last child when I was 31.
Oh my goodness.
Freddie was born the year that I was 31 years old.
Okay, excuse me, I'm going to stop this now because it's starting to beep.